1 Samuel chapter 4. We'll be reading the entire chapter together. Please rise for the reading of God's word. And the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out to battle against the Philistines and encamped beside Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped in Aphek. Then the Philistines put themselves in battle array against Israel. And when they joined the battle, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men of the army in the field. And when the people had come into the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord from Shiloh to us, that when it comes among us, it may save us from the hand of our enemies." So the people went to Shiloh, that they might bring from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who dwells between the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. And when the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted so loudly that the ground shook. Now when the Philistines heard the sound of the shout, they said, "What does the sound of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" Then they understood that the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp. So the Philistines were afraid, for they said, "God has come into the camp." And they said, "Woe to us, for such a thing has never happened before. Woe to us! Who will deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with all the plagues in the wilderness. Be strong and conduct yourselves like men, you Philistines, that you do not become servants of the Hebrews as they have been to you. Conduct yourselves like men and fight." So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated, and every man fled to his tent. There was a very great slaughter, and there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. Also, the Ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. Then men of Benjamin ran from the battle line the same day and came to Shiloh with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. Now when he came, there was Eli sitting on a seat by the wayside, watching, for his heart trembled for the Ark of God. And when the man came into the city and told all the city, cried out. When Eli heard the noise of the outcry, he said, "What does the sound of the tumult mean?" And the man came quickly and told Eli. Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were so dim that he could not see. Then the man said to Eli, "I am he who came from the battle, and I fled today from the battle line." And he said, "What happened, my son?" So the messenger answered and said, "Israel has fled before the Philistines, and there has been a great slaughter among the people. Also, your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the Ark of God has been captured." Then it happened, when he had made mention of the Ark of God, that Eli fell off the seat backward by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died. For the man was old and heavy, and he had judged Israel 40 years. Now his daughter-in-law, Phinehas's wife, was with child, due to be delivered. And when she heard the news that the Ark of God was captured, and that her father-in-law and her husband were dead, she bowed herself and gave birth, for her labor pains came upon her. And about the time of her death, the woman who stood by her said to her, "Do not fear, for you have borne a son." But she did not answer, nor did she regard it. Then she named the child Ichabod, saying, "The glory has departed from Israel, because the Ark of God had been captured, and because of her father-in-law and her husband." And she said, "The glory has departed from Israel, for the Ark of God has been captured." Thus far the reading of God's holy word. You may be seated. Children are masters of manipulation, aren't they? It seems like they will do almost anything and to get their way. They keep on asking and asking and asking until their parents are worn down or given in. Or they embarrass their parents. Have you ever gone into a store to see some mother who has just been disheveled and her child crying, "I want that, I want that," and just crying and making all kinds of fuss, and the mother saying, "Fine," and giving the child whatever it was that the child wanted. Or if the child asks for something and asks one of the parents and says, "Can I have this? Can I do this?" And then that parent refuses. They go to the other parent and say, "Can I have this? Can I do this?" The response, "Well, what did Dad say?" "Well," and they come up with some kind of an answer, not really wanting to say, "Dad said no," so that they try to divide and conquer and to get their own way. But children are not the only masters of manipulation, are they? There are many other people who are also masters of manipulation. If we were simply to look at ourselves, I think that we all might need to admit that we know how to manipulate in one way or another, right? You see, used car salesmen, they often have a reputation for being manipulators, for selling you something more than what you needed, or selling you something that is actually a lemon. Have you ever been guilty of manipulation? And if you got what you wanted, were you satisfied? Maybe some of you have said yes, and maybe some of you have said no. But in our text today, you will see that God will not be manipulated. In fact, he uses the attempted manipulation to fulfill his prophecy concerning the house of Eli. As we look at the book of Samuel, we find ourselves here in chapter 4 in a bit of a transition. The first three chapters of the first book of Samuel have focused our attention on this little boy that was asked of his mother Hannah, whose name was Samuel, given or asked of God. You learn about this little child who was dedicated to the Lord and to the service of the Lord, and how the Lord spoke to him and prophesied to him in the third chapter concerning the destruction that was certainly going to come upon the house of Eli. Samuel's words echoing that of the prophet in chapter 2, who had also declared that Eli's house would be judged. In chapter 4 through chapter 7, however, Samuel completely disappears from the scene. What you have is a focus now in these chapters upon the fulfillment of God's judgment upon Eli's house and also upon the people of Israel. You remember how the book of Judges ended. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. And you see that worked out here once again in this chapter as the people of Israel go to battle against the Philistines and are defeated. Last time you saw that God spoke once again to a nation that had largely forgotten him as he came to Samuel to declare his message to him. And I want to show you today that God will not be manipulated but accomplishes his purposes. You will see this in the defeat of Israel and in the destruction of Eli's house. First of all, the defeat of Israel. The Philistines soundly defeat Israel, who trusted not in God but in the symbol of God's presence. Notice how this chapter begins. It actually begins with that word, "And the word of Samuel came to Israel," which is a conclusion of chapter 3. And then you have, "Now Israel went out to battle against the Philistines and encamped beside Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped in Aphek." You have this very simple description of the battle that took place. You're not given the reason for the battle. You're not told who went out in battle array first, whether it was the Philistines or whether it was the people of Israel. You're simply given a description of a battle between these two nations. Who were the Philistines? They were migrating sea peoples. They had settled in the southwestern coastal plains. They had established five principal cities, Gaza, Ashdod, and Ashkelon, all along the coast of the Mediterranean Sea, along with Gath and Ekron, inland, further inland, closer to the hill country of the people of Israel. And we're told they gather at Aphek, which is along the banks of the Yarkon River, about 20 miles northeast of the city of Ekron, about 20 miles as the crow flies west of Shiloh, the place where the temple of the Lord, the tabernacle of the Lord, had been established. And there the Philistines set up in battle array. It's a great place for the battle to begin. And Israel, they established themselves by Ebenezer. Ebenezer may mean the stone of help. We're not exactly sure where its location is, but it would have to have been somewhere close to Aphek. And it is a very simple battle. It's a battle that took place. And what is the outcome of the battle? The Philistines put themselves in battle array, and they joined battle, and Israel was defeated by the Philistines. Just a simple, they were defeated. They went out to fight, and they lost. But we're given this detail, that they were killed about 1,000 men of the army in the field. This wasn't simply a little battle, a little skirmish. 4,000 men died in this battle against the Philistines. But that didn't seem to deter the people of Israel. For they gathered together. When the people had come into the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines?" You see, after a battle, they had only lost 4,000 men. They regathered to talk strategy, to figure out what their next move and their next step is going to be. But there's one thing that they did recognize, and they recognized it by means of this question: "Why has the Lord defeated us today?" They recognized that there was something that had taken place, and they couldn't put their finger on it exactly, and that God had not been with them and had given them into the hand of the Philistines. You see, they don't seem to realize the reason for it. You and I, of course, we understand the reason for it. We have what the writer of the scriptures has given to us and has described to us before. We have the sin of the people. The very great sin even of the leaders of Israel. This reminds me of the account of Achan in the book of Joshua. You remember Achan, don't you? He was the man who had taken some money and some clothing and from the city of Jericho and hidden it in his tent. And they went and the Israelites attacked Ai. It was a small city. It was not a big deal. "Oh, we don't need the full force. We'll just send a small group of men to attack the city of Ai." And they go, and what happens? They're soundly defeated. Why? Because of the sin of this one man, Achan, who had disobeyed God and stolen from the Lord that which had been dedicated to him. Here you have a very similar picture. The people of Israel have gone to battle against the Philistines. They had every reason to expect that the Lord would grant them deliverance from their enemies and that they would defeat them. After all, they were God's people. And suddenly, they are taken back in surprise. And they are in wonder. Why has the Lord done this? But do you notice the response of the people? Instead of turning to the Lord and seeking the reason for it, it doesn't even begin to dawn on them that it could be because they had sinned against the Lord, that they had abandoned the Lord, that they had turned away from the Lord. And what do they do instead? Well, they say, "Well, let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord from Shiloh to us, that when it comes among us, it may save us from the hand of our enemies." They did not understand why the Lord had allowed them to be defeated, but the one thing they did know is they wanted the Lord there. They wanted him to be present in the battle. And so what more surefire way of making sure that the Lord is going to be in the battle, on the field with them, than to take that very symbol of his presence, of his rule, of his authority? After all, the Ark of the Covenant had gone before the people of Israel through the wilderness. The Ark had been there when they had defeated Moab and Sihon and Og, king of the Amorites. And it had been there when they crossed into the land of Israel, when they had crossed the Red Sea. The covenant, the Ark of the Lord had always been with the people, had always granted them victory. And so why wouldn't the Ark give them victory in this battle against those heathen Philistines? They desired God's presence, and if God wasn't going to come with them, they were going to take him. They were going to bring him with them. They were going to force him to come and to gather together with them. It's interesting to note that as you work your way through this chapter, you'll notice that the Ark of the Lord is, or the Ark of the Covenant is mentioned 13 times in this particular chapter. What is this Ark of the Covenant? Well, it is that box that Moses had made, upon which were two cherubim, supernatural beings representing those who served God. Their wings were touching over the top of the box, which is called the mercy seat. The Ark of the Covenant was the place where God set his feet. It was his footstool. It was symbolic of the presence of the Lord. But more than that, it was the Ark of the Covenant. What did the Lord command Moses to put into the Ark? He commanded them to put into the Ark the staff of Aaron that had budded, along with a jar of manna, which the people of Israel had eaten in the wilderness journey, along with the two tablets of stone. It was the place where God ruled, and it was the repository for God's law. It was God's dwelling place, the place where he chose to meet with his people. What's interesting is that of these 13 times, it is referred to by the Ark of the Lord as well as the Ark of God. When it is in Hophni and Phinehas' hands later on, you'll see that it is called the Ark of God. But here it is called the Ark of the Lord, Yahweh, the divine name of God, but in the hand of Hophni and Phinehas, it was just in the hand of God. There's a bit of a distinction, it seems, in its usage. And the second half of the chapter, it's always the Ark of God that had been taken captive. What would the Ark of God do in their presence? They believed that it would save them from their enemies. You see, the people of Israel had forgotten that it is God who saves and trusted in a symbol instead. Such is the nature of man apart from God, to serve the creation rather than the Creator. The Ark had become a talisman rather than a sign pointing to the reality that God himself is with his people. They trusted in the thing rather than in the God who made it. How easy it is for us to trust in our things, in the things that we do, in our religious practices, in our worship of God, in our attendance at church, to be the means by which we meet with God and that God is pleased with us. You see, we never gather together to worship a symbol. We worship God himself. I think that's one of the reasons why in the Ten Commandments, God commands us not to make a graven image or idol of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. For God is spirit, and you are to worship him in spirit and in truth. He is eternal. He is infinite. He is power, wisdom, holiness, justice, and goodness and truth. God is all of these things, and he cannot be represented by any sort of image. And yet, the Israelites trusted in a symbol. They had forgotten the one whom the Ark pointed them towards. Such is the nature of man. And so they send for the Ark, and the Ark comes. We're told that the two sons of Hophni and Phinehas were with the Ark of the Covenant of God. It's not a surprise that Hophni and Phinehas are the ones who bring the Ark, is it? They're the ones, after all, who are serving in the tabernacle. They're the ones who are offering the sacrifices on behalf of the people of God. And yet it is these two men. You know them. What were they like? They were godless men. They were unfaithful men. They did anything but keep the commandments of God, and yet they were the ones who were with the Ark, bearing the Ark into the battlefield. For they too were confident that as long as they had the ark with them, that they would be safe. And when the ark comes into the camp of Israel, all Israel shouted loudly. They had shouted so loudly that the earth shook. There was just this roar of delight and pleasure and confidence because the ark was with us. We've taken God and he will go with us. And there's nothing that God can do because we have the symbol of his presence. This was a roar of confidence. They were filled with courage and with joy. The God who had brought them into Canaan was now with them to defeat them, to defeat the Philistines before them. And they believed that their victory was sure. Their roar was a great war cry. Literally, it was a war cry, a blood-curdling cry in the ears of their enemies. For you see, the people of Israel believe they can manipulate God into doing their bidding. But now notice the Israel's second defeat. What was the response of the Philistines? What was their reaction when they heard this shout come from the camp of Israel? It was one of confusion, fear, and courage is the result of this resounding cry that the Israelites have made. Notice the confusion. What does this sound mean? What is going on? There is an unearthly shudder of the earth. What's happening in that camp of the Hebrews? And you'll notice that the Hebrews is the first time it's used there, and they're using it in a derogatory sort of a term. They're referring to the Israelites by terms of their ancestry, not in terms of their geopolitical designation. What is going on over there? Do you know? Do you know? Why are they shouting like that? Then we're told that they came to understand that God had come into the camp, for it was the ark of the Lord that the people had brought in there with them. And so their reaction moves from fear, from confusion to fear. For the presence of the ark of the Lord provokes fear, but it also provokes determination. Notice how they cry out, God has come into the camp. God has come into the camp. You see, they understood and they believed that the gods were local gods belonging to a people or to a territory. And the Israelites had finally taken their God and brought him into the battle. They feared the local gods because they were powerful. In a certain sense, it was like the Philistines believed that Israel had a home court advantage because they had God on their side. Israel had invoked God's presence, not just his name. Doom was spelled out for the Philistines. And notice what they cry out, woe to us, for such a thing has never happened before. They had never faced Israel and their gods. Now you must understand something about the Philistines and Israel. They had been fighting and battle with one another for a long time. You remember Samson. What did he do? He over and over again provoked the Philistines to anger, such to the point where he pushed the temple over and 3,000 men were killed along with Samson on that day. There was no love between the people of Israel and the Philistines, but never had Israel invoked the name of their God, much less the presence of their God, in battle against the Philistines. Woe to us! This has never happened before. Woe to us! Who will deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? Notice their view of Israel's God. They believed that Israel served many gods. For indeed, Israel did serve many gods. They weren't simply serving God in Shiloh. Yes, there were a few people that would come faithfully to serve God, like Elkanah and his family. But there were many people who were worshiping all sorts of God, borrowing from the pagan nations. And the Philistines knew that, and they saw that. And they said, Israel has taken not just one, but all of their gods into this battle. And so they cry out, war, woe is me, for these mighty gods. These gods who are powerful have come into the camp. And how do they know that they're powerful? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with the plagues in the wilderness. Don't you just love that description of the Philistine description of Israel's God? The God who struck the Egyptians in the wilderness with the plague. Is that what you read in the book of Exodus? Were the Egyptians struck by the plague in the wilderness? Were the Egyptians ever into the wilderness? You see, this describes the befuddled understanding that the Philistines had concerning Israel's God, the jumbled tale of God's victory over Israel's enemy in Egypt. You know how a story grows with the telling? Well, that's what had happened here. It was no longer that God destroyed them by the plagues in Egypt. Now they were in the wilderness and were being destroyed. And these are the mighty gods that Israel has brought in to face and to attack the Philistines and to destroy them. But what was the result? The Philistines were moved from fear to woe to determination. So they say to one another, "Be strong and conduct yourselves like men, you Philistines, that you do not become servants of the Hebrews as they have been to you. Conduct yourselves like men and fight." They were determined not to lose this battle. You see, this cry, this roar from the Israelite camp, which was intended to invoke fear in the Philistines, in the end had the opposite effect. And it gave them courage so that they could go into the battle and fight. You see, the Philistines, they knew they had everything to lose if they lost this battle. They did not want to become subject to the Israelites as the Israelites had been subject to them. And so they encourage each other, conduct yourselves like men. Act in such a way that you give a good account of yourself, even if you have to die. Rather than run away in fear, quaking at the knees because the presence of the God has come, they are determined to fight and to win. And so they dig their heels into battle. Notice the knowledge of God can produce two types of reaction. They can produce the reaction of godly fear and repentance, or ungodly fear and rebellion. The Philistines, they feared God, but it did not drive them to retreat. It did not drive them to turn from the battle. Imagine their shock, that the Israelites' shock that they were defeated. Instead of running in fear, they dug their heels. They raged against God. They were not about to submit and to worship God. You see, and that's what we find in our society today too, isn't it? That when people hear about God and His mighty power and the wonderful things that He has done, they recoil, they turn back, and they hurl insults against God, and they're going to fight and do everything they can to destroy God. And so the Israelites go into battle. You have this second description of this battle. Verse 10, "So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated, and every man fled to his tent. There was a very great slaughter, and there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers." Again, it's just a simple description. You would think you'd get the in and out details of this battle, but it's simply, they fought, Israel lost. Imagine their shock that Yahweh had not given them the victory. They had taken him into battle, and they were destroyed. This was the first time since Achan that they had lost a battle. And it's not that they just lost the battle. This was a total rout. Every man fled to his tent. They didn't simply go back to the camp and regroup to fight again. No, they went home. They went past the camp, looking for security in their homes. They abandoned military service altogether. And notice it was a very great slaughter. Literally, it was an abundantly great slaughter to match Israel's great shout of confidence, but a much greater destruction, a much greater slaughter. This wasn't a little skirmish. This wasn't a little battle. It reminds me of the Battle of Antietam, the bloodiest battle in the one-day battle in the war between the states, where 23,000 men were killed. I don't know if you've ever stood on the battlefield of Antietam, but you can just imagine the carnage that was there. This battle was worse, for 30,000 of Israel were killed in battle that day. That wasn't just a little victory. That was a total rout. And what was the result? Well, notice the result. The Ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. They died in that battle. You begin to see here, Israel was manipulating or seeking to manipulate God, but rather God was accomplishing his purposes. What had God promised? What had God declared concerning Hophni and Phinehas? That both of them would die on the same day. This was the beginning of the fulfillment of the judgment on Eli's house. And it's not surprising that Hophni and Phinehas were killed, since they were carrying the ark. You see, Israel assumed that God would help them. And indeed, many today assume that God will deliver them in spite of their persistent wickedness. So many believe that they can live however they want, and then when they die, the minister will preach them into heaven. They can get into heaven on the coattails of their parents or on the coattails of the good works that they have done, assuming that God owes it to them. Israel assumed that God owed them the victory, but they were defeated. God will not be manipulated, but will accomplish his purposes. Notice the destruction of Eli's house. Judgment is carried out on Eli's house because of his sin. The writer gives three reactions to the report of this battle defeat, that of the city, that of Eli, and that of Eli's daughter-in-law. The first is the reaction of the city of Shiloh. We're told that a messenger, a man from Benjamin, came the same day. He came with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. He was a man who had been there. He had witnessed the slaughter. We're not told why he is described as a Benjaminite. Could it be that it had some relation to what is to take place when Samuel anoints Saul later on in this book? But what is interesting is that he came on the same day, the day that the ark was captured, the day that Hophni and Phinehas were killed. This man comes to Shiloh, no doubt running to his home, seeking refuge, and he reports the battle. His clothes were torn, and there was dirt on his head. Torn clothes, as you would expect from one in battle. Dirt on the head was a sign of sorrow, loss, and sadness. And whether this was from the fight or as he was running, he took that dirt and threw it upon him. His appearance, his very appearance, did not bode well for the news that he was about to bring. But notice, we're told that this man is coming. And then we're told that Eli was sitting on a seat by the wayside, watching, for his heart trembled for the ark of God. And when the man came, and so he was waiting and he was anticipating. Now, a little later on, we're given some detail about Eli. He was 98. Remember, we're told that he was abundantly old. He was a very old man. But not only that, we're told that he was blind, that he could not see. And here we're told that his eyes were so dim, literally in the original, it says his eyes stood up. He could not see from his eyes anything. And so here you have the irony of Eli sitting at the gate, watching, waiting for word. And this man with his torn clothes and dirt on his head comes running into the city, and Eli doesn't see him. But we're told that his heart trembled. Literally, his heart was fearful on behalf of the ark. He was filled with anxiety, for he had charge of the ark. You would think that he'd be more concerned about his sons, Hophni and Phinehas, but his focus is on the ark of God. He knew that they'd put the ark in danger. Maybe he had reservations regarding what Israel did. Maybe he disagreed with what they were doing. Yet, nevertheless, he sat. You see, there is a blindness of heart in some who, when given the warnings of God through his messengers, still can't see the danger that they're in or won't see it. God was beginning to unfold his judgment against Eli and against his house. And there Eli stood watching and waiting. And you have the simple report of the messenger. And he came into the city and told it, and all the city cried out. The city just cried out. They began wailing and mourning. No doubt their husbands and sons had been in the battlefield. No doubt they feared the worst for their own family members. But now notice the report to Eli. When Eli heard, he asked what was going on. You can imagine Eli's surprise as he's sitting there looking towards the battlefield to hear this commotion in the city behind him. He was looking for a report, and yet it had come past him. And he asked, what is the noise of this uproar in the city? What is this agitation, this turmoil? And the man who had been at the battle came and gave him a firsthand report that he had been at the battle, and he had been there, and he saw it. And you have this simple summary. So the messenger answered, Israel has fled before the Philistines. That's not good. And there has been a great slaughter among the people. That's sad. And your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead. Oh. And the ark of God has been captured. Then it happened, when he made mention of the ark of God, that Eli fell off the seat backward by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died. Notice the progression from the 300,000 that died to the death of his sons to the capture of the ark. It wasn't the death of 3,000 men that shocked Eli. It wasn't the death of his two sons that shocked Eli. It was the capture of the ark of the Lord, the symbol of God's presence among his people. And when he heard that, no doubt he threw his head up and his head back, and he wavered and he toppled and he fell over. And he struck his head and broke his neck and died on the same day that Hophni and Phinehas died. The same day that they were killed, he was also killed. We're told that he fell over because he was an old man. He did not have the ability to control himself as well as he could when he was younger. But we're also told that he was heavy. No doubt he had enjoyed the fruits of his son's sinful labors in the temple, eating that wonderful, choicest meat taken from the people during their sacrifices. And we're told he had judged Israel for 40 years. It is in the sense of leading the eternal internal affairs of the people of Israel that Eli functioned as a judge. He functioned more as a ruler than as one who were to sit in a court of law. Remember, he had been sitting at the gate for years, listening and speaking and advising those who came to Shiloh, and he died. But notice the third reaction, that of Phinehas' wife. Now his daughter-in-law, Phinehas' wife, was with child due to be delivered. And when she heard the news of the ark, that the ark of God had been captured, that her father-in-law and her husband were dead, she bowed down and gave birth. She was expecting. She was late in her third trimester. Perhaps a few weeks before her due date. And when she received the report, she went into labor. And she labored hard. And her son was born. But she died of the complications of that childbirth. The news was too great and too sudden for her. Perhaps she and all of Shiloh had not expected that this to happen, that they'd been defeated. What I find interesting is that Phinehas had a wife, and that she was expecting, and that she had been faithful to him, for he certainly had not been faithful to her. Remember in chapter 2, I believe it was, where he had lain with the temple women, the women serving at the temple. Phinehas had been anything but a godly example. And yet now, when she hears news of the ark's capture, Eli's death, and her husband's death, she goes into labor, and she too is about to die. But the midwives seek to give her encouragement, and they say, "Do not fear, you have borne a son. You have someone to carry on the family name. Hophni and Phinehas are dead, and Eli is dead. But don't worry, the house of Eli will continue with your son. And she doesn't regard it. We're told that she doesn't, in the original, she doesn't pay attention to it. It didn't matter to her that she had given birth to a son, for the enormity of what had taken place had come upon her. And so she does not answer. She was so caught up in what had just happened, and she names her son Ichabod, literally, where is the glory? And what is the reason for this name? The reason for this name is because the ark had been captured. The ark where God himself would meet with his people. Remember, when God would come down to meet with Moses, he would come down upon the mercy seat. And Moses, when he left the tabernacle, his face would glow because he had been in the presence of God. It had been taken into captivity. This was a sad day for Israel, indeed, for Eli and for his daughter-in-law. The capture of the ark was devastating, for the glory of the Lord had departed. And did you notice something in all of these descriptions of what took place? It was always the ark of the Lord. It was the ark of the Lord that was last. It was the ark of the Lord that was the center. But when she is told that the ark had been captured, you notice it's the ark, her father-in-law, her husband. And Hophni and Phinehas are always treated last in the list. Why? Because they had been judged justly for their sin, for what they had did towards God, and how they had misused his service and his sacrifice. For you see, God finally is going to do what he said he would do. God will not be manipulated, but he accomplishes his purposes. You see, God will sooner depart with his glory than to permit his purposes and commands to be thwarted. You see, Phinehas' wife, Eli's daughter-in-law, cries, "The glory of the Lord has departed," at the news of the capture of the ark of the Lord. But in reality, the glory of the Lord had departed many, many years before, when the people of God, God's own people, did not serve him, when they would not follow him. God, who was Israel's glory, had left them, for they had abandoned God. You see, God isn't a tool to be used at someone's convenience. God isn't someone's puppet on strings to be pulled and directed towards the pulpit master's will. God isn't someone who will allow his glory to be tarnished by the unbelief of his chosen people. God abandoned his people for a time to teach them on whom they must depend. Indeed, God's glory would disappear from among his people in order that it might reappear ultimately in his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. For the glory of God is Jesus Christ. Jesus, who came into this earth in order to deliver his people from their sins. Jesus' glory radiates through his people. Jesus is the glory of God's radiance. Remember what Isaiah says? "Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord is risen upon you." And who is that glory? Christ, the Maker, the Redeemer of all God's people. You see, brothers and sisters, the people of Israel were to radiate the glory of Christ in their worship, in their activity, in everything that they did, and everything that they said, but they did not. But that the people of God was the Old Testament church. What about the church today? Isn't the church today to radiate the glory of God in Christ Jesus? And if the church doesn't radiate the glory of Christ, who will? If the church refuses to glorify God, God's glory will depart from her. But God uses even these things, even the capture of the ark, in order to accomplish his purpose for the people of Israel, that they might ultimately turn to the Messiah, that they might ultimately trust in God to redeem them from their sin. Brothers and sisters, beware of using God for your own advantage. Do not try to manipulate God, but rather trust in his promises, trust in his working out in the difficult situations and circumstances that you might face. Can you trust God? Absolutely. For God will do what he said. If he destroyed Hophni and Phinehas and Eli's family for their sin, he did what he said, didn't he? He will also save those who come to him in repentance and faith. But you see, you cannot use God for your own ends. God simply won't be manipulated. God isn't a genie in a bottle waiting to grant you your wish when you rub the bottle. What God requires of you is faith and obedience. That's not what the people of Israel exercised, but God was about to show them something different. While children may have learned to become manipulators of their parents, God will never be manipulated by his children. For those who will not serve God according to his ways, his glory will depart from them. But those who delight in God and his ways, his glory will shine through them, the glory of Christ in their lives and in their hearts.